Okay, I admit it. Sometimes I do go into the YouTube rabbit hole where I watch video after video. And for that reason, I would encourage you to subscribe to the Focus Core YouTube channel. That way, if you also find yourself in that rabbit hole, that you'll have some of the best videos, podcasts and case studies about companies that are thriving in Japan, and you'll be able to see and hear these real life cases that are relevant to you and your business here. So take a moment, open up your app, and subscribe to the Focus Core YouTube channel. Now on to our podcast.
In Japan, it's different from the West because, again, it's risk averse. It's a very a culture that respects humility and group-oriented kind of values. You can't be bold and shout at the top of the rooftop. It's about, try to avoid self-promotional storytelling, which can be off-putting for Japanese audiences. You want to be more contextualized, relevant to case studies, customer testimonials. How is it used? How is it applied in similar business situations with companies in your industry or different industries? So make it more relatable through your customer's voice. Like I shared with the event example, right? They could build that human emotional connection and rational, embedded storytelling in a different form. It's not always just creating copy or content and publishing it. It's storytelling through an event, through a personal connection. So that's how we try to help our clients localize their stories, keeping in mind the Japanese companies and the challenges that they face, their businesses face.
Welcome to the Focus Core podcast, where we dive deep into leadership, talent, and the evolving world of business in Japan to help you focus in on your core business. Today on the Focus Core podcast, we're joined by Robert Helt, co-founder and CEO of Custom Media, an award-winning bilingual B2B market agency based here in Tokyo. For more than 17 years, Robert has been helping global brands tell their stories and expand in Japan through strategic marketing, PR, and digital innovation. Originally from Madras to the Maldives, with a background in hospitality, Robert took a dive as an entrepreneur, and now with nearly 2 decades of digital marketing and strategic communications under his belt, he is an acknowledged leader in the Tokyo business scene. With an MBA from McGill and additional studies at MIT Sloan, Robert brings both creativity and a sharp business mind to the table. He also serves as president of the newly created AIM B2B, which we'll be diving in today. Robert's mission is simple but powerful: to bridge Japan and the world through effective, engaging storytelling. I love that. Welcome, Robert.
Thank you, David. It's a pleasure to be on your podcast, and I'm looking forward to our conversation.
Thank you. So we've been floating around in Japan together for a long time, and this is kind of the first time to get down and sit down and chat, which I'm very excited about. But it's kind of always known Custom Media and your work around the chamber and the magazines for so long, which that's also evolved. Maybe it's helpful for our listeners to kind of understand your journey to where we're at today. So maybe you could kind of tell us about you and your journey.
Sure, yes. So yes, I moved to Japan in 2004, and coming from a hospitality background, I was always curious about advertising and marketing. And when I got to Japan, it was really eye-opening, right? Coming from India, where there aren't many, like at least for me growing up, there wasn't many kind of advertising avenues. Just Japan was eye-opening. There's like advertising everywhere, on the trains, on the handrails, and it just, for me, was fascinating to see the wonderful and the weird advertising in seen in Japan. And it kind of got me interested in advertising in general. I did a business degree in my undergrad, and was always interested in business and in commerce, and kind of advertising fit into that bucket. So I was curious to get started in advertising. So I got a job doing advertising sales for a publisher. Did that for a few years, and then decided, you know what? I can do this myself. I would like to be a publisher myself. I would like to launch magazines. And that's kind of what started, my entrepreneurial journey. I was ambitious and keen to become a leading publisher for English magazines in Japan. And so in 2008, I started Custom Media with a business partner, and we launched the British Chamber of Commerce's magazine. They didn't have a magazine. So we launched BCCJ Acumen, and we did a really good job with that publication. And later were invited by the American Chamber to take over their publication, which has been in the market for a very long time. So the ACCJ Journal, we started publishing that, and was invited by the Canadians to take on their publication. And that was really good time for us. We were the only publisher to, have all three magazines for the American, British, and Canadian chambers at the same time. And that was quite, fascinating for us because, I could see this vision for us to launch a publishing business kind of, grow. And, a few years after that, the Tokyo American Club invited us to be their exclusive advertising agency, handling all their ads for their print magazine, for their digital media. And we still have that relationship. We're still their exclusive, advertising agency in Japan. Yeah, so from that, we built a really strong reputation for content, great content and storytelling. And, through this, we started winning all sorts of marketing production work. Clients would come to us and say, can you help us with our website? Can you help us with marketing collateral, with videos and so on? So we started to transition from being a publisher to a marketing agency, right? And then a few years ago, we realized that we needed to clearly define our value proposition for our clients. Simultaneously, print media, the good old age of print was starting to decline, and in came the global digital advertising, platforms like Google and Facebook and X, Twitter, and the likes. So we had to transition our business as well. And we decided we needed to clearly define our value proposition for our clients. We've been working and helping global B2B businesses in Japan through, advertising and coverage and editorials in the chamber magazines that we manage. And over the course, we've built a very proprietary kind of process that we help clients with. Always, we start with discovering who they are, who their audience is, what kind of target clients they have in mind, who are the competitors. Then, from that discovery, we would build a strategy with them. What are the right channels? What's the right messages? Then we create the content with them, execute, and then kind of always kind of looking at optimizing to deliver better value. So this process was always there, and we've been doing this like for the last 17 plus years. This kind of inspired us to build a bold B2B agency offering. So we redefined and refined our value proposition, created a three-step framework, which is adapt, implement, and maximize. And from that, this AIM B2B agency offering was born. And then we are now, helping clients with AIM B2B.
That's great. Well, let's start big picture, and then we'll move down into the nitty-gritty of the day-to-day, what you're doing. Let's talk about Asia. Let's talk about Japan specifically, and how marketing is different in the regions. We were talking beforehand. You'd mentioned how you partner with, like, say, other companies in China because it's just different than Japan. And how does, Japan differ the rest of the world and find it unique in their marketing?
Yeah, you're right. I mean, marketing across Asia is very different. Each country has, different cultural differences. I come from India. India itself is a huge market. You've got the north, south, east, west, and I'm from the south. What we have four languages just in the south, right? So culturally, it's quite a mixed pot. And so what strategies you have for winning in the south will not work in the north or in the east or west. There will be similarities, but you really need to understand those local cultural differences, right? And this goes beyond just translation, right? So markets like Japan, Korea, China, they require complete cultural adaptation, including visuals, including messaging, including, how you approach storytelling, right? And then there's so many digital platforms. Unlike the West, there's in business, LinkedIn does very well. in the West, right? But in Japan, we know it's not LinkedIn, right? It's different platforms. Line dominates, you know, generally, you know, platforms here. In China, it's WeChat. In Korea, it's KakaoTalk. WhatsApp is pretty prominent in the Southeast Asian kind of market. So each market in Asia has their own ecosystems. And it takes time to build trust with, you know, your buyers in the market. So in Japan, you know, what we try to do with helping clients in Japan is first to really understand, you know, what the Japanese buyers are looking for, their customers are looking for. Japan is quite unique in business. I was always fascinated by this. One of the countries that, you know, Japanese is the core language of business, and it's in the G7. I mean, look at all the other G7 nations. What is the common language for business, right? Yeah. And that actually, you know, motivated us to do more because we saw this disconnect between global brands struggling in the market and helping them with, you know, creating bilingual communications, bilingual content that shares their stories. In Japan, you know, buyers are risk averse. They expect real detailed proof of and validation of what your product or service offering is and whether it would be, you know, work in their business context. And it's a consensus driven, you know, business environment, right? Where there's lots of consensus within teams before they make decisions. Typically, B2B buyer journeys, you know, there's about, you know, depending on the business and the size of the business, there's anywhere between 6 to 10 key decision makers in your buying committee, right? B2B journeys are quite complicated in and of itself, right? Bring that to Japan, it's 2 or 3 times more complicated, right? There's a lot of consensus-driven, you know, decisions. So you really need to build relationship and trust. The first thing we tell our clients is like, let's focus on, you know, building awareness, building trust, and building relationship. The business will come. But if you don't get this foundation right, you're not going to succeed in the market. And, you know, what's also unique in Japan is, compared again to the Western world, is, you know, hard sales tactics don't work. The sense of urgency, do this right now, take this campaign, and try to push decisions don't work. They backfire, right? So you need to understand how that works in a cultural context. Create sense of urgency, but, you know, smartly, not aggressively, right? So those are kind of ways I feel that, you know, what we're doing with helping our clients understand the Japan market.
Yeah. I think the market itself is creating its own urgency just on how things change with AI or aging population. It's driving our own Japanese urgency, which I don't think we've seen in the last couple of decades, which is interesting.
Yeah. I would add, you know, digital transformation was the buzzword for the last few years, and COVID accelerated that. And what that has seen for us is we have started to receive a lot more interest from global software as a service brands like SaaS companies, software companies that are helping Japan to, you know, transition from the, you know, analog world into a digital world. And Japan's embracing that, right? So then if you have a quality SaaS product, you know, let's work to educate the market how your product, you know, brings value to their, you know, offering. And then also kind of find out how does it integrate? You know, Japanese companies tend to have the larger the company there, they tend to have very, you know, old infrastructure, right? Your product might be cutting edge, but does that work with their infrastructure? First, try to understand what is their infrastructure, build your product with them, and try to adapt your product or solution to their infrastructure, then you're going to create a win-win, right?
Now, I think I wanted to ask you, you know, what do you think global B2B brands get wrong when they try to enter Japan? You've already talked about kind of not integrating with infrastructure and not building with companies. Anything else that you would highlight that you think brands get wrong coming into Japan?
It's this whole process of localization. Localization isn't just translating your website. And, you know, I mean, that we've seen, you know, companies do it with Google Translate and whatnot. And I think the brands have become smarter since then. And also technology has become smarter. But localization isn't just about translating your website and having a good Japanese language website. It is localizing your product. You know, we worked with a major a software brand, you know, that does project management, right, and workflow management. And in our engagement with them, they were spending a lot of money in advertising and getting, you know, early test users, early subscriptions as to trial subscriptions, but they were not converting. So we said, hang on a second, your marketing is working, but how is your product in Japanese? Give us the platform. We want to try the platform in Japanese. In English, it was an amazing, you know, user interface. So when we started digging into the Japanese platform, we found so many disconnects between the user experience. And we did a 6-month research for them and gave our findings that, look, your product is great, but it doesn't work in Japanese. You need to go back to the drawing board, fix your, localize your product based on how Japanese users want it, and then come back and you'll be more successful. You know, and that brand has come back. I would imagine they've taken our, you know, advice and come back stronger in the market, right? So it's about localizing your product, not just your messaging, and then also making sure you're creating local case studies, local customer success stories that you can share. How is your, if you have customers already in the market, that's great. If you don't, it's a little bit more tricky. If you don't have customers in the market, bring relevant global case studies that are going to, you know, make sense, resonate with your Japanese buyer. And the minute you have your first Japanese customer, try to create local customer stories with them. Get them on board because they will be your advocates. You know, if your brand is working with a major Japanese household name, that is your in, right? That can create confidence in other buyers. In Japan, we know it's like always who's going to take the first step, right? And once you've had somebody take that first step, leverage that, you know, constructively with your customer, and that will help you to find other customers.
That's brilliant. Yeah, I highlight that for anybody listening that's trying to come into Japan. It's really difficult if you haven't localized things, but once you get that first customer, really highlight that and create case studies. I think that's so important. Going back to your topic about just localizing, you'll see it in recruitment over and over where the CRM that the company's using for candidate tracking, there's oftentimes, I was working with one retailer, they had 8 staff doing talent acquisition. They had a global system, but no one in Japan used it. They just used Excel because it wasn't in Japanese. And if you take a look around at some of these global companies and you look at their career boards and you say they'll have all their jobs listed globally, but not in Japan. Mm. And it's specifically because the system doesn't work in Japanese. And so they're losing Japanese candidates in this case. But it's that localization, the localization experience for the end user in SaaS products. It's just so, so important. So great advice there. Can you share an example of a campaign that really resonated with the Japanese audience?
Yeah, sure. Just thinking back, you know, we worked with a leading cybersecurity company that specializes in identity access management solutions. And they, you know, they work, their product and technology work specifically in the financial sector. They work with large banks, right? So you've got the national banks, and then you got the regional banks. Japan has so many regional banks. Yeah. So their focus was, okay, we want to engage with the regional banks. They didn't have a major Japanese bank as a customer, right? And so they came to us and said, how can we engage with the regional banks? So we looked at, okay, why don't we create a, you know, thought leadership type, you know, roundtable discussion where you and your Japanese customer, you know, discuss and share best practices in the industry and talk about the issues that banks face in terms of identity and access and the challenges around security around that. And based on that, you know, content, we will then go and, you know, attract, try and target a niche group of C-level leaders in technology and CTOs, basically in the financial sector, and get them to this kind of small, you know, roundtable discussion where you can engage with them, talk about challenges, share best practices, share your learnings, And you know, that would help a to have face-to-face engagement with your audience, but also build thought leadership and create value for them. So we went out and, you know, based, we created the event with them, you know, chose a really nice high, you know, scale venue. Actually, it was at the Tokyo American Club, you know, created a nice atmosphere, great event. You know, it was a dinner session where, you know, we invited, you know, we targeted, looked at who are the core target audience, focused on reaching those independent, you know, those CTOs, these various financial institutions, invited them, personalized invitations, and got a really small, you know, niche group of 15 executives in a room, right? That really created good opportunity for the client to, you know, interact with them, you know, share learnings, discuss issues. And, you know, it was a really successful event at the end of the day, you know, that created a new opportunities for the client with, you know, potential target companies, but also position them as a thought leader. Then they can take that content piece and then share it, you know, on their own channels and create more digital marketing and communications around it. And at the same time, you know, their customer that they're working with, you know, was able to also showcase that they're a leading Japanese bank that's at the forefront of addressing this issue. They were proud to talk about it because they want to show that, you know, they are, you know, looking at this issue on a large scale and are working with, you know, global service providers to address, you know, cybersecurity challenges in the industry, right? So that's one very good example of localizing, very, you know, focused, very niche, right? Now you could do an ad, you can do some editorials, you can do some, you know, publications around that, all well and good. You could do that afterwards to kind of continue the brand awareness. But first, creating this intimate session where you could interact with your customers and your potential customers is the key.
That's great. Yeah, it's so much you can do around that. It's sounds like a great event. Let's move philosophically into storytelling. I've talked with other guests about marketing, and we've talked a little bit about how different marketing is in Japan and how different Japan is in general. But let's talk about how storytelling is different in Japan, because you're passionate about storytelling. And I imagine that the way that you engage B2B storytelling is different than it would be in, say, the US or other places in Asia, right?
It is. And I think even just to go a little bit one step back is B2B versus B2C, right? B2C storytelling. As consumers, we, you know, we relate to products, and those products create emotional connections with us. We use it in our everyday, you know, whether it's a simple basic product to a luxury product, they create those emotional connections and bonds with us as consumers. And B2C marketers are really good at understanding that emotional bond, that emotional connection. And they leverage that in their advertising campaigns, in their messaging, in, you know, we've all seen the amazing, you know, ads, you know, in various platforms, right? So we remember those ads that connect with you, right? So B2C, they do it very well. In B2B, you know, it's more challenging because products and services are often very abstract, very technical. You know, it gets more to how does this product or how does the solution work for my business, right? But it's hard to create an emotional connection. It's what you think, but actually it is easy if you think about how, you know, your product or solution is helping the intended user, the intended company. At the end of the day, B2B is not business to business, it's business to business people. Still, decisions are made by business people, right? Humans are involved in the decision-making process. It may not be one person. As an independent consumer, you go out and you buy that Apple phone, iPhone, you want it, you get it. But as a business, if iPhone is the right product for your entire business, you still need to make that decision with other business you know, leaders in your company. So you want to create content that is, you know, a little bit more talking towards, you know, how B2B buyers make decisions based on trust, based on alignment internally, based on confidence. So if you understand those three triggers, you can then build the relevant stories that connects with those decision makers in those, organizations. And then you can bring out the emotions and the rational, right? It's not just emotions, it's the rational. It's a, you know, $100,000 purchase. It's a $1 million purchase for your business. What is the rational behind it? And how can you, build that consensus within your team by showcasing that products, service, technology, whatever that is, that kind of connects with us, with our company. In Japan, it's different from the West because, again, it's risk averse. It's a very a culture that respects humility and group oriented kind of values. So you can't be bold and shout at the top of the, the rooftop. It's about, try to avoid self-promotional storytelling, which can be off-putting for Japanese audiences. You want to be more contextualized, again, relevant to case studies, customer testimonials. How is it used? How is it applied in similar business situations with, companies in your industry or different industries? So make it more relatable through, through that. And again, through your customer's voice, like I said with the event example, right? It's through the customer's voice. They could build that human to human emotional connection and rational, and that is storytelling in a different form. It's not always just, creating copy or content and publishing it. It's storytelling through an event, through a personal connection. So that's how we try to help our clients localize their stories, keeping in mind the Japanese companies and the challenges that they face, their businesses face, right?
That's great. And I, hearing you speak, another thing that strikes me is that longevity is an important part of, a lot, especially when you're dealing in technology, you might have a lot of new companies coming in and wanting to work with Japanese companies. But when it's B2B, especially in Japan, these companies are conservative and they want long-term relationships, as you mentioned. And I know for myself as well, we're both company owners and we probably look at long-term, a new company coming in, you and I probably both look at these companies very skeptically as well. It's like, what's your long-term vision? How are you going to work with me 5 years from now, 10 years from now? It's a very important aspect as well for these companies.
Yeah, I totally agree with your commitment to the market, right? And we've all seen it, right? We've seen big global businesses spend a lot, enter the market, only to leave a couple of years later. And unfortunately, they've created, a wrong reputation for global brands in the market, right? So it's about how do you distance yourself from those that have tried the market, invested, failed, and left quickly, right? And they create that, okay, our global brands committed to our market, committed to, helping us in the long term, right? So you're very right. The commitment is key.
What's a totally random question for you? Your favorite B2C emotional commercial? For example, the 1984 Apple one's easy. My favorite's always Michelin with the baby over the tire because a baby had nothing to do with that tire, Michelin tires. It was a good commercial. How about yourself?
Yeah, for me, when I started off on Microsoft products, Windows and PCs, right? So the PC versus Mac commercials, they were very tongue-in-cheek, but very memorable. And they create a whole series of it, right? And, they say once you go Mac, you don't go back. And, I'm fully in a Mac environment. And being in the creative industry, right? When we started the business, we got Apple, computers for everybody, not only just the creatives. Some agencies would just get it for the creatives and everybody else would be working on PCs. And then there was this big formatting issue between the two computers and so, it's all about, okay, we got to go in one ecosystem and do everything in that ecosystem. The only PC we have, again, this is just showing you what, how Japan is different, is for accessing the Japanese bank account, which has to be on a Windows computer on a Japanese language PC. And that's the biggest frustrating part, but that is business, right?
That's so funny. I was just sitting there going, yeah, I got one Dell in my office and that's it. That's for the computer, for the banking.
That's the only purpose it serves, nothing else.
That's funny. Well, let's jump into the AIM framework because you kind of alluded to that, talking about adapt, implement, maximize. Okay, let's dive deeper into that. What Tell us what that means in those components.
Yeah, so, as I explained, from our five-step process of discovery, strategy, creative execution, and optimization, that's been our framework that we've been helping companies, just by default. We didn't even codify it. We were just doing it. Okay, first find out what the client wants. Okay, let's create a strategy. And then as we sat to sit down and kind of really work through what are we doing for our clients, right? We could see the work we are doing, but we couldn't codify it yet. So we said, okay, let's sit down and codify what are we doing for our clients and create a proper framework that we can share with the client so that they can see it, visualize it, and then know how we're going to help them through each stage of their journey with us. When we started doing marketing production work, it's pretty simple. Clients say, okay, design the brochure. We'll design the brochure. We would ask them, why would you need this brochure? Who's your audience and whatnot? But we didn't think beyond that. We just thought, okay, this is a product. They need it. We get it done. But as we started to help clients solve problems, business problems, it's often like we need more customers. So they would come to us and say, we want to run this campaign, but we would ask, so why do you want to run this campaign? As we started to dig deeper as to the objective, the goals of their campaigns, then we started to realize, you know what, we need to bring more strategic value to our clients, not just productional, executional value. And when we started to work with clients more on a consultative basis, we realized we needed to have a clear framework. And we created the AIM framework, which is Adapt, Implement, and Maximize. And again, this is something we've been doing in our entire business history. Now we just, focused and codified it into language that's aligns with our team, so we know which phase we are with our clients and aligns with our clients, so they know, what's the journey they're going to go on with us. So in the Adapt phase, this is purely about, discovering what are our clients' visions, what are their goals for the market, who are their target audiences, what's the competitive landscape like? What's the industry trajectory like? Is this a growth industry? Is it a stagnant industry? What are the options? Who are the people making decisions? What is the buyer persona like? So we do a lot of discovery. And based on that discovery, we then create a strategy. Okay, this is the channel. This is your audience. This is the expected results from that. And based on that strategy, we started to localize the content, localize, like I said, either the product. If the product's not right, go and fix the product, because no matter what you do, you're not going to sell here. The product is just not going to work. So product market fit, localize the communication, the messaging on the website, any local case studies. That all happens in the Adapt phase. And then we go into the Implement phase, which is actually creating. Now that we have a strategy in place, now that we know who the audience is, now that we decided, okay, it's going to be on this channel, it's going to be through, the Nikkei IT media channel. Okay, what does that mean? What are the assets we need to have that engagement? So we create the content, create the stories, and then we go into executing it. Okay, we run those campaigns in the Implement phase. And then we look at what's the results out of this. This is our assumptions. So we make assumptions based on data, based on research. Marketing end of the day is you've got to make some assumptions and go with it. But if sometimes it doesn't work, what do you do? Do you still continue? So we look at it and say, okay, if it doesn't work, why is it not working? Let's go back to the step that where we may have made a wrong assumption and fix it. So we're constantly looking to track and measure the campaigns, the activities, and then, help clients to maximize it by improving, the campaign. And look, it's a competitive industry, whatever industry you are. So if you do something, expect your competitors are paying notice, and they're going to do something to, compete with that. So you need to understand that and monitor that activity. So then you can come back and say, okay, this is now we need to go into a defensive campaign mode, or we need to go to an offensive campaign mode, because what the industry is telling us or what the competition is telling us, right? So it's always constantly looking, understanding what's working, what's not working, tweaking it for that marginal, result, marginal improvement. That is the maximize phase. And we keep repeating this process in helping our clients to achieve value and results.
How do you measure success in campaigns? That's always seems a challenge. How do you do that?
It starts with what's the objective of the client, right? If or the campaign, is it brand awareness? Brand awareness is at the top of the funnel. If nobody knows you, first you need to be known, right? So if it's about brand awareness, it's more about long term. It's about planting seeds, right? And then when you want to measure whether that campaign's working or not. So for example, with a client that we've been working with in the market recently, you know, they've been in the market for 20 years. They've had some stagnant growth and they needed to find new customers, right? So we helped them with creating content to raise brand awareness as to what are their products' benefits. It wasn't just about price or technology. It was actually about ergonomics and, you know, how their end users utilize the product and health and wellness. So we identified that as the key USP of the product compared to the local competitors. So we created content around that, did press releases, engaged with media. So when we published that, put that out in the market to create awareness. So when their salespeople contacted clients and talked to them, clients would typically go and search for it. And then, yeah, I read about it.
Okay.
That's the impact. So now they know about the product and it makes the salesperson's job a lot more easier rather than going and trying to pitch that, you know what, this is what our product does, this is how we are different, blah, 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 blah. If they've read about it, they've heard about it, you've achieved that brand awareness stage, right? So that is when it comes to brand awareness, which is often the very first step for and this is for a brand that's been in the market 20 years in Japan. So brand awareness isn't just about new companies entering the market. Sometimes, you know, even if you're in the market, you need to constantly, you know, show what's your innovation, show what's what you're doing in terms of keeping up with technology and what the demands of the market are, and talking about it, right? So that's in the brand awareness phase. And if you're going more into like the sales funnels account phase, where it's more, you know, account-based marketing, it's more mid-funnel or at the end of the funnel, then it's more about lead generation. So if campaigns are specific to, you know, getting more traffic to your website, number of downloads for your, you know, white papers, attendees to your webinar, those, it's easier to track, you know, those campaign effectiveness, because then you're investing in it and you're seeing traffic to your website, you're seeing click-throughs, you're seeing downloads. That's a little bit more easier to measure. But again, it's more hard to attribute because, you know, these days buyers are on different platforms where they're looking for information. So it's difficult for you to say whether it came from this Yahoo ad search. Again, Yahoo is still big in Japan. Clients are always amazed when you say you need to invest in Yahoo. And they're like, what? What is that? Right. So, but we actually find Yahoo is a very good platform for search and display advertising because we can work to define audiences, especially B2B audiences, and Yahoo delivers really good. But you got to stay on Google to keep that, you know, again, that searchability and ranking at the top. So yeah, those are some of the ways we help to, you know, define campaign effectiveness. But it all starts with what is the objective and then how can we deliver that objective?
Okay. So, you know, having that objective out there and then working backwards, seeing what metrics can or cannot be measured. Sometimes marketing things are just out there and you can't really, it's not clickable. And that's when it's a challenge, right?
Indeed. And so we work with clients first to establish those KPIs, establish those metrics. What are you expecting out of this? If you do that upfront, then you know what where your goalpost is, and then you know you can get alignment. Because sometimes what happens is we deliver the campaigns, we do the work, and then clients say, "Oh, I didn't get results, so I'm gonna, you know, fire you and go to another agency." But hang on a second, what was the result that you wanted? So it's the onus is on us to define that result ahead of time with the clients, so we can then align, you know, and show where we're bringing value and whether we're delivering that result or not.
That's great. Let's talk about how AI is changing your approach to content, to demand generation, to account-based marketing. Because it's, I mean, just recently I saw something like LinkedIn, for example. We started seeing all these kind of old posts coming up because now the algorithms changed and it's favoring not organic, non-AI created information. So then it's, you know, all the marketing you might have done around AI a couple of months ago. Now it's irrelevant. Thank you for, LinkedIn for doing that. I mean, but any platform can do that. And so it's interesting. How do you find that AI is changing the way you, again, content, demand generation, account-based marketing?
Sure. We do an annual content marketing survey focused on B2B, marketers based in Japan. And we just
Great.
published our 2025 survey. And first of
we'll
all,
put a link to that's and that we can get that on your website.
Yes, and I'll share
Great.
with you the link.
We'll
You
put
can
it in
share
the
it.
show notes. Great.
Yeah. We started the survey last year, and the reason we started the survey was, we do a lot of content. Content is such an important part of the buyer journey. Buyers want to understand the business. And as I said earlier, Japanese decision makers, they want the information, they want the content, they want to do their own research. A well-informed buyer is a better prospect than an ill-informed and not enough informed buyer, right? So that's why we launched the survey, to really understand what buyers are doing and how they're using content, to aid the buying decision. So last year's survey, we talked a little bit about AI. It was kind of starting to just kind of make waves in marketing, right? 52% of the surveyors that we spoke with were not using AI. Only 19% was actively using it, but 29% was experimenting it. 1 year later, our survey this year, 73% have said that they are already using AI in their content creation, activities. And, off that, one of the key stats that we also kind of, wanted to understand how are marketers adapting with AI, and also what do marketers see as the key skills that, you need for creating content in the future, in the next 3 years, for example, 1 to 3 years. And the number one skill was AI proficiency. 83% said AI proficiency is the number one skill that marketers will need to create content. And the second was data analysis. Again, there's so much data being created, so much content being created, there's so much data out there. We need to better understand the data to make informed decisions. And the third was creative writing. So it's very telling. You're using AI for data, but you still shouldn't lose that creativity, right? So, what we are seeing, I think, in terms of how AI is changing content creation, what we try to do is we use it for more ideation and research and understanding. Human, creativity is very important, especially now more than ever. Our slogan is humanizing brands and storytelling. And we can do that because by understanding what the end decision maker, being a human being, what is their emotional connection? What is their rationale behind it? It's difficult for you to get AI to think in those terms. You can get AI to create the copies, come up with the strategies and whatnot, but you need to validate that. And that's where the human intelligence is very important. AI can be used and leveraged for data, for segmentation, for analyzing. So we use tools, that helps us to, monitor our campaigns. So we run campaigns for clients across various platforms. So we use AI there to understand which platforms are performing better, what messages are resonating better, and how we can use that data and knowledge to improve our return on those campaigns. That's where AI would do, I think, an even better job and get more better in hyper-personalization and, helping us to better understand our end buyers, end customers. And I feel that's probably where AI is going to lead. And I was reading an interesting article just yesterday about a research done, where students were given a task to create content with the use of AI and without the use of AI. And then they were interviewed as to what the experience was like. And the feedback was that human-to-human connection, when two people were said, go off and create a piece of content, versus a person said, go and use ChatGPT to create the content, the human-to-human aspects, actually they found they were more creative. Whereas when you're just working with the AI, you miss that human creativity. You got, and what happened was the students were more relying on AI to create the content, whereas when you're doing it with another human being, there was more interaction and the human beings were more involved in the creative process. So the creativity was actually better in terms of the output and value than what just came generated from AI. So I don't know, it's still early days, but it's definitely changing our industry rapidly, and we need to understand and appreciate what's happening in technology and be prepared to adapt with technology.
Yeah, that's great. I just I've studied so much communications, and I always think about how technology changes what, I've been teaching salespeople, and at the end of the day, when I teach salespeople, I'm teaching communications, how to ask questions and listen to answers. And that hasn't changed. And AI, in some ways, won't change, technology won't change a lot of what good communication means and how people communicate. And that's what people really like, is that connection and how to do it. So it's, I think the person of the future will have to learn how to thrive in a human-centric world with technology around it, which is an interesting proposition.
Indeed.
Got to end us off, I got a lightning round for you, Robert.
Okay.
To jump into some ideas for you. Coffee or tea?
Coffee. I'm a morning coffee person. I try to limit it to 2 cups a day. I can't drink coffee after 4 or 5 p.m. It's not good for me.
same as you.
But interestingly, when I'm in India, it's tea. It's a very tea culture. So it's always, a cup of tea.
Yeah, fair enough. But the tea's different and it's good, right? It's
it's chai, yeah.
What's your favorite place in Tokyo to recharge?
I like to go to Daikanyama. It's a really, little nice neighborhood. Lots of bookstores and, fancy shopping kind of area. So
I was wondering if you'd say that because it was on your website. One book you think every business leader should read?
Just one book?
Yeah, you can give us five if you want. It's a...
Yeah, I mean, as entrepreneurs, for me, a book that has recently transformed the way we do business and is Traction. It's about the entrepreneurial operating system. Yeah.
Cool. I do not know that book. I will go and seek it out. Morning person or night owl?
I'm a morning person, definitely.
Yeah, me too. One thing people might be surprised to learn about you.
But I recently started to do kickboxing, and I'm really enjoying it.
Cool.
I like to do sports and playing cricket growing up, and I try to keep an active lifestyle. I do a fair bit of running. I know you're an avid runner, but I started doing kickboxing more to stay fit, and I really fell in love with it. So I, on the weekends, I try to go to my local gym, kickboxing gym, and yeah.
Awesome.
Train.
It's great. It's a great way to do it. What's a brand campaign you wish you created?
Ooh. I think one of keeping in B2B, I think Salesforce created a really good campaign. I'm trying to think, the Einstein campaign. Yeah, that was really memorable in how they leveraged that. Yeah, I wish we created that.
Nice. And last one, who inspires you most right now?
Who inspires me most right now? Wow, that's a tough question. I get inspiration from my team. That our goal, at Custom Media and at AIMB2B is to inspire and be inspired by our amazing team. So my team inspires me every day. And it's not cliche, it's what we really live for. And we come to work and we talk about what's inspired you today and, how you're inspiring others. So I think for me, it's really our team.
It's great. So, and I've worked with parts of your team. I've done some writing for the magazine with Simon ages ago. You guys have helped us business-wise and done things with our website, and your customer service has been wonderful. What you do is really fantastic for and impactful for Tokyo and Japan. So it's been
thank you
wonderful
very much.
To talk to you.
Likewise, no, thank you. Thank you for doing business with us. And yeah, likewise, I think it's been a really good experience of my team working with you and your team as well. So I appreciate it. I'm doing the uptown lowdown, yeah.